We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, FM 90.9 HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us today. Ashley Merriman is our guest this afternoon. Over the past couple of years, she and fellow journalist Poe Brownson have been looking at childhood development. They're the co-authors of the new book, Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. The premise of the book? Well, here's how they put it. Many of our strategies for nurturing children are backfiring because key twists in the science of children have been overlooked. The authors say a lot of what we think we know about kids is wrong. For example, excessive praise can have negative effects. The authors looked into our ideas about a number of other issues, including racial attitudes, lying, sibling conflict, and what leads to childhood obesity. They say at first they were stunned by the research they examined, but soon came to see, in their words, the new thinking about children felt self-evident and logical, even obvious. Ashley Merriman is a writer and attorney living in Los Angeles, where she runs a church-based tutoring program for inner-city children. Her work with Poe Brownson has been honored by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a Clarion Award, and an award for outstanding journalism from the Council on Contemporary Families. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Ashley Merriman. Feel free to join the discussion with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children, is published by 12 Books. Again, the numbers, if you'd like to join us this afternoon with a phone call, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Ashley Merriman, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me today.
My pleasure. Well, the book's first chapter is The Inverse Power of Praise, and you say at the outset, sure, he's special, but new research suggests if you tell him that, you'll ruin him. It's a neurobiological fact. Now, how can telling children they're smart be bad for them?
Well, you know, we want to make clear that it's not that that is ineffectual. It's actually very effective to say, honey, you're so smart, when the kid got a good grade for a test, or, you know, oh, you're a genius, when he drew a picture. But the thing is, kids get really invested in that idea. It becomes part of their identity, and they become afraid of doing anything that would risk losing that praise. You know, a researcher at Stanford, Carol Dweck, has found that kids who are praised for intelligence are more likely to choose an easy task that isn't challenging, and they were less likely to learn a new activity they only want to focus on. Did they get it right? Not, you know, did they, you know, and they don't care about actually learning the fact. It's just, did they get that little gold star, and then they move on.
Mm.
And we've actually found, a researcher named Robert Cloninger, that praise triggers the ventral striatum, which is the reward circuitry in the brain, in the same way that any other kind of reward or exciting experience triggers it. So you can actually change the way the brain emits dopamine, which is the hormone that actually does sort of say, hey, brain, you're getting rewards. This is great. And the amount of praise can actually change the pattern of the chemicals in the brain and how we respond. And all of that's fine until we experience failure. But then suddenly the dopamine's gone and the kid says, what do I do now? And we don't give them strategies to keep going forward when all we've told them is, you're so smart.
Yeah. So it depends on the praise given and the circumstance.
Yes. I mean, Carol's work really shows that what we don't want to do is focus on praise that talks to a kid in terms of who they are as a person. You know, you're smart, you're talented, you're pretty. Because that then sort of gives them this idea that success is based on this innate skill, and you've either got it or you don't.
Mm.
And what we want to do is teach kids that success is based in something that's their control. They have the ability to change their fate. It's up to them. So what we want to do instead is say, praise them for their effort. How did, you know, it wasn't just, oh, honey, you know, you're so smart, you got an A. It's, honey, I'm really proud that you studied every night and you memorized all of your vocabulary words. Look, it paid off. Because now the kid knows, hey, you know, maybe if I do that again, maybe I'll do okay on the next quiz too. If you just say, oh, sweetie, you're just so brilliant, what does he do? The likelihood is he's not going to get a perfect score every time. And at some point, he's going to be like, hey, I guess, you know, effort is for dummies because that's what, you know, those other kids who struggled had to do, and now I have to put in effort. Maybe I'm a dummy too.
Yeah, and also I would think that if you kept up that hyperbolic praise, that pretty soon a kid might think, Mom or Dad, I don't think you know what you're talking about.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, actually, they've done research on this, and they've shown kids videotapes of other children being praised and asked them, what do you think? And only kids under the age of 7 actually thought that the praised kid was doing well. The kids over 7, when they saw a teacher come up to a kid and say, oh, honey, you're so great, said, oh, that kid must not be doing well. Because they're so used to hearing praise not as an actual recognition of achievement, but as a way of manipulating kids into doing more and encouraging them when they're struggling. So, yeah, actually, most kids don't believe praise when they hear it. And we are concerned, and the researchers are concerned, that parents and teachers and other caregivers sort of chip away at their own credibility because they're constantly saying, honey, you're a genius because you tied your shoes and you didn't trip over.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that doesn't mean they're a genius. So they start asking, well, are you a reliable person who, when I have actual questions and trouble, you're just going to give me some happy party line, or you're actually going to tell me how I really need to fix what I'm doing?
Yeah. So how did we come to believe that telling a child he or she is a genius was good for that child?
Well, there was a researcher in Canada who published a book in the 1960s and 70s called Nathaniel Brandon on the importance of self-esteem, and he had opined that self-esteem was the most important thing in a person's psyche. When you had a good self-esteem, that was it. And some of what he wrote, you know, there were other aspects to it, but that's the one thing that people sort of latched on to. And by 1984, the state of California actually created a state task force to improve self-esteem. I live in California, so I can make fun of the Californians. And that actually sort of set this ball rolling. And the idea was kids who are struggling, kids who are perhaps in low-income circumstances or neglected, if we increase their self-esteem, that will increase their achievement. And it sounds like such a great idea. And who wants to tell you, no, you should let kids who are struggling feel badly about themselves? That doesn't make any sense. But Roy Baumeister did a meta-analysis looking at research, 10,000 studies about self-esteem. And his intent was to prove once and for all how important high self-esteem was, and it did indeed lead to more achievement. And he realized that of these 10,000 studies, only about 200 were actually good science. Because he asked in those other 9,000 studies, yes, they found that people with high self-esteem were smarter, they were more intelligent, they were better colleagues in the office, they were even more attractive. But they found out that the reason is they asked people, what do you think about yourself? When they asked their roommates or the bosses, you got a completely different story. So they really started learning that self-esteem boosting doesn't lead to more achievement. More achievement leads to better self-esteem.
Hmm. You say even those who've accepted the new research on praise, though, have trouble putting it into practice. So how might we think about putting it into practice, rethinking what we've been doing for so long?
Well, I'm one of those people, actually. I have, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, I've been tutoring kids in inner city LA for 11 years, and I thought if they, you know, walked in the door without falling on their face, I would tell them they were brilliant and make up for all of the bad stuff going on in their lives. And this was not a subconscious thing. This is my stated intent. If you asked me, I would have told you that. But, and I was worried. I was like, I tell them they're smart all the time. And I had nightmares that some doe-eyed little five-year-old would say, Ashley, you used to tell me I'm smart, but you don't anymore. Do you not think I'm smart? At which point I would find the nearest cliff and throw myself off of it. And what I found is, I would say, if the kid really worked hard, I don't praise kids who are just messing around, but if they worked hard, I go, wow, sweetie, you worked really hard at that, didn't you? And they look at me and go, yeah, I did. And they actually, rather than no one's ever missed, no one's ever complained that I don't tell them they're smart. Instead, they are like, wow, you're actually really paying attention to what I'm doing. And they're excited about that idea, and it makes them feel that, you know, it matters, because it's really easy to walk around and tell a bunch of kids, hey, you're smart. It doesn't mean I'm, you know, actually even have any idea what they're doing or what they're capable of.
Mm-hmm.
But when you actually take a minute and say, what do you think about this? How did you do this? Mm-hmm. I liked the way you opened your essay with the description. That's the first time I've seen you do that. Then they get really excited and engaged. So I think, you know, it does take some practice, but the sort of fear that, you know, kids are missing out isn't something that bears out. And I think the other thing that I've heard from, you know, Poe, my co-author, and other people who had when they were first exposed to this was, so they really sort of realized they had been using praise as an expression of saying, of love. We're not saying, don't say I love you to your kid. What we're saying is, saying I love you, you're so smart, may not be the best thing, because you may be sending your kid a message, and my love stops if you are stopping to be smart.
Hmm.
So what we want to do is we just want to separate them.
Mm-hmm.
We'll say, I love you, and hey, look at the grade you got.
Mm-hmm.
They're two separate things, and they're not dependent.
Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Ashley Merriman, together with Poe Bronson. She is the author of Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. I look forward to hearing from you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's nice to hear your voice, Celeste, and I'm delighted with your guest. Having taught for almost four decades, I can promise you children have an intuitive understanding of who is paying real attention to them. And I honestly believe that it is more about demonstrating a respect for the child. You have self-respect, you extend it to the child, and that tells any child who's trying hard to learn that you know who they really are and that your expectation is built on your respect for them, not whether you happen to like what they're doing at that moment, not whether you think they are a genius. We have only so many geniuses, and typically schools don't do a great job of even identifying them. Show respect to yourself, to your kiddos, to your students, and they will learn, and they will acknowledge by their effort that you know who they really are. I don't think it's about great amount of praise. It's about attending and showing respect. I'm going to hang up and listen to your guests' comments. I hope this has an incredibly wide audience. Kids deserve the best we can manage. Thanks so much for your guests, Celeste. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Ashley, you want to comment?
Oh, that was so sweet. Thank you. I do. I really agree. I mean, with my tutoring kids all the time, they're so fixed on are they smart or not and how smart is what matters. And I keep saying, you know, honey, I'm smart. If you break your leg, do you want me to fix it? No, because I've never read a medical book. And it doesn't matter how smart you are. If you don't put in the work, you're never going to get anywhere. So I really, you know, it's a real issue that kids are really so concerned about this. And when they're in school, you know, especially, you know, in the 4, 5, 8-year-olds really start becoming aware of those social comparisons. You know, how do they stack up compared to someone else? So it's so important to really try and focus kids on what they're doing. And encouraging them to, you know, focus on that rather than trying to label themselves as who they are.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener waiting for us in Effingham. Line 4, hi.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Celeste. I have a couple of questions. First, has your guest ever heard of Wilhelm Reich?
Yes, but can you be a little more specific what it is you're...
Well, focus on sexuality and gleanings from Freud's work and the role that sex plays within the human life, and which, and I agree, it starts very young, probably before we're born. But nevertheless, I mean, there is that element of praise and of good deeds and a great many other things that are term positive, and how a child responds. I'm a father of 7 myself, 5 girls and 2 boys, and they all did okay. But the thing is, the influence that I had on them before school and after they went to school, and my influence was minimized, and their dealings with each other and the same-sex relationships between boys and between girls and girls, and how that plays out, I think the thing is much wider than we perceive it to be. Do you have any comment about that?
Well, I definitely think that kids are also praising each other or insulting each other for smart, so you're talented or you're athletic or whatever. It's not just adults. I think the adults just reinforce to the kids that those kinds of labels are important. And we also, there are some indications there may be more, some gender differences. Girls may be more sensitive to the sort of person-oriented, you're smart labels than boys, because boys tend to, when they're playing together, do a sort of more rough-and-tumble name-calling. So if they're playing, hey, you're a dummy, hearing, hey, you might actually be a dummy in class just seems sort of less hurtful, and they can sort of throw it off. So I do think some of that is there, but the research on it is still kind of being worked out.
Well, how does that occur? You know, a boy and pre-testosterone poisoning, and how they learn what they learn as males and who from. I think there is a great deal that needs to be more study with these things. If, you know, since maternalism is diminished in human society, that's where I think a lot of the problems begin, that when mother and her ability to deal with all the things that kept coming from a child, and a father who, you know, after fathers came into existence, and the sort of nurturing that they began after a child was a certain age. Why? But that's my comment. Why the smart or unsmart, or that being part of the totality of an education up to a point, you know, when in lower adulthood, and everything that happens in between. I mean, we live in a violent society, and being smart, in rough and tumble terms, is surviving. And that requires a great deal more attention and dialectical activity in order to survive in that environment. So, well, did you say you had heard of Dr. Reich?
Yes.
You have?
Yes.
Yes, and how far did you take that?
I'm not an expert in his work because mostly we were focusing more on social psychologists and educational psychologists when we were talking about the praise and motivation.
Yes.
And other researchers like University of Research, Rochester, at D.C.,
yes.
And Ryan and colleagues like that. So we were looking more on the motivation concepts.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Very interesting show.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We've got another listener waiting to talk with us in Champaign. Line one, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
My son began at a local middle school this fall, which is a horrendous beginning. I mean, just a terrible. And by the end of the semester, he was on dean's list or honor roll. But all through the fall, we saw sloppy work, missing work. And what we found is that they are rewarding really so-so academic ability with honor roll. They've dipped the standards so low, and I'm worried that it's going to create a counter motivation to excel. What do you think about that?
I agree that people's expectations fall. They may rise, but they can also fall. That is true. And one of the things that was sort of, for me, really interesting about the self-esteem research was, you know, like I had mentioned before about we thought that increasing self-esteem increased achievement. And actually what we've learned is that increased self-esteem means you're innately great. You don't need to improve. You don't need to work hard because I've told you you're great. In fact, Ray Baumeister did this research where they emailed students in college who were in an intro psych class, and the professor would email them when they were getting C's, and he would say things like, you're doing really poorly in my class, but I just want to let you know I think you're a good person. And the people who got that email, their grades dropped even lower. Well, why? Because why do you try and work hard in class? To impress the professor. This professor said, I'm impressed with you regardless the caliber of your work. So the caliber of their work actually declined even further. I think for your kids specifically, struggling in middle school, especially the first semester, is extremely typical. I think most psychologists working in the field would say it was almost expected because there's a new social environment, there's new friends to work out, there's just finding class and not, you know, and then there's learning about what is actually expected of you. It takes a lot of time. But what I would do is, especially if you're concerned that he's not challenged enough or not working enough, is go back to those questions of, you know, don't just give him praise if he got an easy A. Say, did you work at this? And if he said, well, no, not really, you don't need to praise him. What you need to say is, well, then is it okay if we find something that you're going to learn from and that you would be challenged with and get him focused on the interest and the motivation of learning rather than I did what was expected of me. I can now just check that box off and move on and do whatever else I want to do.
Yeah, boy, when you start to think about this, you think, could this lead kids into situations where they're not challenged and essentially a part of them shuts down, could it even lead to, you know, dropping out, whether or not you're in the classroom or not? You know what I'm saying?
Well, it was fascinating when we first started doing this research. We had some teachers, and obviously there are a lot of teachers out there who were concerned about what's going on, but we had some teachers saying, yeah, I know I do grade inflation, because if I don't give my kids good grades, the parents and the administration mm-hmm. complain, so I just have to give everybody A's even if they don't deserve them. But that's okay because they'll go to high school. And then I heard that from high school teachers. They're like, but that's okay because they're all going to college, and in college they're being prepared for the real world. It'll work. And then I had college researchers whisper to me, I can't tell you this, but we're doing it too because the administration says that if we don't keep all those students, we lose the money from having those butts in the seats, so you better give them a good grade so they don't mm-hmm. change universities. But that's okay because they'll go to the real world, and in the real world, it'll be okay.
Yeah.
And then I found news reports of employers who have daily programs where if you show up to work on time, you get a Starbucks gift card. I mean, literally, they are rewarding them for showing up as opposed to actually doing their job or even excelling at it.
Yeah.
I think there's huge consequences in this, and we really need to start thinking about it very carefully.
But not being challenged is so deadening. I mean, you don't want to be, like you said earlier, mm-hmm. you know, you can't set a bone. I mean, you're smart. But I don't want to come and tell you, you know, I've got a medical problem, and
right.
Ashley, can you fix me up?
Mm-hmm.
So, but it seems to me that why isn't being challenged and engaged more exciting?
Well, I think the focus is, you know, I mentioned Ryan and DC earlier, and they have this sort of idea about intrinsic motivation and extrinsic motivation. And intrinsic motivation is what we want. That is doing something for the love of it.
Mm-hmm.
Picking up a book because you love to read and you love to learn about new things and think of a new world in your head. Extrinsic motivation is doing something for another reward that has nothing to do with doing it for your love. It's getting that grade because you have to pass that class.
Or the Starbucks card.
The Starbucks card. It's the pizza for a book. It's showing up to work because you need to pay a bill. And anytime you do that, extrinsic motivation, it's so powerful that it kills the intrinsic motivation. They've done studies where they've had preschoolers draw. They had cameras, secret cameras in the preschools, and they watched the kids draw. And at a certain point, the researchers gave some of the kids a certificate with a star because they were such good drawers. And those kids, in subsequent weeks, drew less. I mean, they're preschoolers. They love nothing more than doing, you know, crayons, right? But the idea that, you know, they were literally waiting, when is the next certificate coming? And if they're not going to get a certificate, then they don't love it anymore. So that shift in interest changes to the rewards of other people. And that could be praise, it could be a certificate, it could be a lot of things.
Mm.
But it's really hard to get it back.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Ashley Merriman, co-author with Poe Bronson of Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. Questions, comments are invited. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We go next to a listener on line 4 in Champaign. Hi.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks. Very interesting, very provocative show. Enjoying it quite a bit. Quick comment and then a quick question for your guest. I have a tendency to agree with your guest. Back when I went to college about 1.5 million years ago, the one thing I regained was something called the locus of control, meaning you can affect the outcome. You do have control over your own life. And I think, if nothing else, that's probably one of the most important things we can instill in our children is that they do have control if they study and work hard. My question is, I'm just wondering, if you're from your guess, from a point of view of a child, what kind of a time frame are we talking about? In other words, once the toothpaste is out of the tube, these children, if they're hardwired negatively, can it be turned around? Or by the time a child is 10, 11, 12 years old, is it too late to affect the child positively? And what
do we have to reward them forever because we've started them on this path? I've had a lot of people actually ask that question, and I don't think it's ever too late.
I appreciate that. Where I was going with that is I was just thinking from a systemic point of view with society, the number of single parents, the lack of really parental involvement in a child's life is what's concerning me. And I'm just wondering, you know, can we somehow get back on the right track if you're finding pointed to that at all?
You mean in terms of overall amount of parental involvement?
Yes, yes.
I think that's very interesting. And, I mean, single parents, obviously there is less day-to-day parental involvement because, you know, the parents are working. Although I think it's less true for school-age kids than it is for, you know, your youngest children, right? I mean, if the kid's at school for 5 hours or 8 hours a day, it doesn't matter how many parents are at the home or not.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is really interesting, actually, is that the researchers have sort of challenged the idea that the sort of classic Ozzie and Harriet stay-at-home mom was there all the time waiting for her kids with her little pinafore and a new plate of cookies. And they found that she wasn't waiting for them. I mean, Ozzie and Harriet, well, Harriet was a working mom. And, I mean, people didn't like to think about that, but it was true. And even moms who are stay-at-home moms aren't necessarily there 24/7 for kids. They're, you know, doing housework or, you know, volunteering or, you know, a myriad of other activities. So there's actually not that much difference. We're talking minutes a day between a stay-at-home mom and a working mom's interaction in terms, you know, and for, you know, hugging, the number of times they hug a kid a day, read to a kid a day, they're almost identical.
Mm-hmm.
What I do think is a major change in society is actually not about the parent difference, but peer interaction. The average middle school student has 299 peer interactions a day. It's astronomical.
You're saying peer interaction.
We segregate kids in a way that we've never done before. Kindergartners have different entrances into schools because we don't want to expose them to the older kids. Older kids, you know, play groups are all matched by age. And it used to be when we were a more sort of family and agrarian society, you know, everybody was in the one-room schoolhouse. You had kids who were, you know, little to 18 or, you know, all taking care of each other and learning from each other. And what we're doing a lot of times is letting kids socialize themselves. So it's not about parents so much. It's just about the fact that, you know, kids teach themselves this is the proper code of behavior. There's no one older or younger around to contradict them.
Right.
So I actually think that that's where a lot of the, you know, the real difference comes. And it's interesting to me, there are a couple of different programs like Montessori and other things that actually specifically try and do age block groups so they don't have that straight striation.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi, Celeste. Great show. I was just thinking about overpraising and what it does as far as really young children concerned is that it's confusing because if everything is praised and it's hard for children to form standards. So if every time a child draws a picture, it's framed, put on the refrigerator and praised, and you're such a good artist and you're so smart and everything, then what happens when they draw a picture and there's no one there to critique it or they don't get the praise? So I think that overpraising becomes a problem and that children can't formulate standards of what is good and what is just, for attention or not so good. So if that could be eliminated and be made more specific, you know, even I love the way you draw pictures for me mm-hmm. when you're home, or, you know, I like the way the perspective is in this picture instead of you're so smart, you know, everything you do is perfect. Then as the child gets older, they would be able to form more standards because they would have a more specific frame of reference, if that makes sense.
I think that's exactly what the scholars are telling us to do. And I think beyond just in terms of standards of what would get them more praise, it also just helps them recognize what was successful. I mean, if a kid, if you look at some kid's drawing and you say, oh, honey, that's just the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Yes.
Well, that was just dumb luck on his part. And what's he going to do the next time? Odds are that's going to, at best, be the second most beautiful thing you've ever seen, right?
Right.
So that's one of the reasons why they really do say, you know, instead of saying, oh, my gosh, that's an amazing picture, say, I really like the way you used color here. Because mm-hmm. then they'd be, oh, hey, maybe I should think about color next time.
Exactly.
To me, you know, I thought Carol's really sold it to me when she explained, like, if a kid threw a baseball in a house and he broke a vase, I don't think anybody would say it was a good response to say, you bad kid, you're a terrible kid. You might lose it, and you might yell, and you might say that, but you probably regret it afterwards. You would say, I've told you a million times, don't throw the ball in the house. You did a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if that same kid brought home a vase that he made in art class, honey, you're a genius. He's not a genius. He made a vase in art class.
Yeah, I think the power of words, it tends to get lost in the overpraising thing, because genius means something really specific.
It's not even about whether or not it's that we didn't actually get one particular thing right, like, you know, genius, you know, but he's not actually technically a prodigy. I think it's just more that those are sort of wild overstatements.
Exactly.
Even just saying, honey, you're smart, or honey, you're talented. Well, those aren't necessarily, you know, statements of his entire being. What you're focused on is, did he break the vase? Did he make a vase? Talk about the vase.
And I think kids who are able to form ideas about what's good and what is not very good, and then mm-hmm. they make progress. They strive towards something better, and that instills self-esteem and a desire to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Where just, you know, you're perfect, you're a genius, it's just a given. And that's not real self-esteem, because it's not based on achievement.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my idea. And I think it's a really important topic, because I taught for many years, and in the classroom, you can't even be, you know, that hyperbolic with 30 children. And so some children do get left out, or it's the more demanding child who gets the, a lot of praise for things sometimes, especially in really young children, if they ask for it and they get it. So I think we need a better system for, just instilling that wonder when you learn something, you know, how good it feels. But I'll hang up now and listen, but I'm really enjoying the show.
Thank you.
Let's take another call. A listener also in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Very interesting discussion. I wanted to get back to that question of extrinsic and intrinsic rewards,
mm-hmm.
Because what I'm hearing is kind of psychologists are saying one thing, that the extrinsic rewards have these perverse effects, and sometimes that demotivates kids. But economists say something quite different. And
mm-hmm. right.
You might be familiar with, like, the work of Roland Fryer at Harvard.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he's a...
And they're cutting checks in D.C.
exactly,
and New York.
Exactly. This is a spreading
really, really
movement
upset.
That's well-funded. So could you comment a little bit about those experiments, and possibly also why there's kind of a lack of communication between those different fields about... The findings. I'll take my answer off the air.
I read all of those, and there aren't any actual findings at this point. All of those studies are in progress. There are news reports that are sort of anecdotally, you know, how does that kid, you know, feel that he got his check? And they don't seem to, as far as I've seen, actually be changing any real behavior. And I'm extremely worried, and I get this from the scholars, that once that check stops, that the motivation to continue and to succeed will vanish as well. I think that economists, you know, I don't think if you ask any economist, is a five-year-old's brain the same as yours? They would say, well, sure. But that's, I think, the problem with the economic approach, is that they're not recognizing that there are developmental differences. It's certainly true that if you tell me I'm going to get a Christmas bonus, I'll work harder in December. But is that necessarily the case for a five-year-old or a 15-year-old? There's no evidence that they're going to respond in the same way. And I really think that that's where the economists have sort of been lacking in the analysis that I've seen. And I hope that they start, you know, really collaborating with the developmental psychologists to actually, you know, consider those elements. But I haven't seen any indication that they're doing it at this point.
Well, let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line 3. Hi.
Hi. I have a couple of comments. I worked as a school social worker, and in one school, I just had to do some group work when I was getting my master's. And so they gave me all the, like, kids that the teachers wanted to get rid of that were problems in the class. And I started, and these were, like, you know, the big, tough, well, I mean, it went up to fifth grade, so, but still, the tough, usually fourth and fifth graders in the school. And I started giving them out good news notes if they had behaved well in group and participated well, and they would die for those certificates. I was amazed. I thought, oh, these kids aren't going to care, but oh, my goodness, they wanted a good news note to take home to their mom to tell that they had behaved well. And then in another school, I started what I called the most improved reward. So there were 18 classes in the school, K through 6, I think. And so I had each teacher pick one kid each week, and I didn't care what they had improved in. But I felt that the kids that did well, they got rewarded by the usual rewards of the school, and the kids that did poorly or behaved poorly, they got sent to the school social worker for group work. But these kids in the middle, then, you know, didn't get recognized. And that was very, very successful also. The kids really, you know, they all wanted to go and play social skills games, which is what we did. You know, games where they had to think or brainstorm or participate in some way, but both of those worked really well.
Well, I think, you know, I don't know the specifics of your program. As I said before, praise and rewards are extremely effective. It's not whether or not they are effective, it's that they may be too successful. And when I started my tutoring program, we actually had a star system where at the end of every session, every kid got a star, and at the end of the semester, we'd count up the stars, and the kids who got the most stars got certificates. And it wasn't about who was the smartest, it was just who worked the hardest. So we thought, well, that's, you know, great. It was enough extrinsic motivation that I had kids stealing each other's stars. I had kids ripping stars off of other kids' badges so that that kid couldn't get recognized and they would. And then when we handed out the certificates, kids complained that they didn't get it because everybody should get a certificate and they should get one too. And it just completely derailed. And obviously we were horrified and stopped all of that. And what we really focused on is individual kids and in the moment, are they working on something? And hopefully the fact that they did better in that class encouraged them to come back to tutoring the next week, more than just saying, if you come again, you know, you'll get a prize.
Improved. That's not something that they could steal from one another. The teacher picked one kid every week, and they didn't know what they were being rewarded for, I mean, ahead of time.
We didn't tell them what the prize was. We just told them there would be, you know, we just at the end said, hey, you guys worked really well, and you get a star, and it became a competition for the kids who had the most stars and the most recognition. And once it was a competition, that's all they cared about.
Yeah, it's not at all the same thing that I'm talking about.
As I said, I'm not familiar with the specifics of your information. I'm just saying the general rule is that my experience is pretty representative, which is once you change a behavior to focus on recognition, then kids will do it until the recognition stops. And at that point, you may have a problem.
Yeah, they were rewarded after the fact for something they had done the previous week. And it wasn't, they just knew one kid would get to go to this. But
no, I understand that. But as I said, with the preschool experiments and stuff, they've done it in all different kinds of lab settings and have found, I mean, your program may have done it completely right. Obviously, I wasn't there. I don't know. But I'm just saying for other people who are listening, when you're doing things like that, it's a challenge to find a way to actually have that be that you're continuing to grow their internal motivation and not make it that they're focused on who gets to do the special prize, who gets to do the certificate or the new activity, and be less interested in actually doing that core deed that you wanted them to do.
I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. We've got to wrap up here. We've got some calls we can't take because we're out of time. Ashley, I hope you'll come back on the program with us.
I would love to, very much.
Because we need to talk about sibling rivalry, and we need to talk about the importance of sleep. And
sibling rivalry, the major researcher in the world is at the University of Champaign-Urbana. And I've been there, and I just can't wait to talk to him about it.
And also, there's another person in the book who appears who's a Champaign-Urbana person, Melody Rosales. Her
mm-hmm.
retelling of 'Twas the Night Before Christmas figures in a chapter about talking with children about race.
Right. And so, Phil Rodkin is also at there, and he's done some amazing work with middle school and elementary kids and race and popularity.
Yep. So we will have to have you back on the program.
Thank you. I would love that.
Ashley Merriman, together with Poe Bronson, is author of Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. The publisher is 12 books. June 87.75, the high, 87.40, the low, 87.65, the settlement, down 15. August 87.65, the high, 87.27.5, the low, 87.62.5, the settlement, that down 7.5. January feeder cattle, 96.60, the high, 96 even, the low, 96.30, the settlement, down 25. March, 97.10, the high, 96.47.5, the low, the settlement, 96.75, down 17.5. April, 98 even, the high, 97.50, the low, 97.70, the settlement, down 10. May, 99 even, the high, 98.25, the low, 98.67.5, the settlement, that down 7.5. February lean hog, 67.85, the high, 66.50, the low, 66.57.5, the settlement, down 102.5. April, 71.45, the high, 70.70, the low, 70.75, the settlement, that finishing down 52.5. May, 75.70, the high, 75.25, the low, the settlement, 75.67.5, down 2.5. June, 79.10, the high, 78.47.5, the low, the settlement, 78.95, that up 12.5. February, belly.